just get me on camera alone.
Photo, like, you asleep, being like, and this is our interview.
Zima.
This is the order of battle.
Thanks for joining the Order of Battle podcast for another episode. Joel, Jason, and sometimes A discuss collecting G.I. Joe, other 1/18 scale action figures, and in general, what sparks joy. It's a lot of things, but almost always toys. This is the Order of Battle podcast. 3 weeks ago, I was in Des Moines, Iowa at Assembly Required. This year's theme was the Iron Grenadiers. It was incredible. Friday night after, you know, both the fun family dinner, but also the family dinner with some touching moments, I had the opportunity to sit down with Josh Blaylock. Now, this is not the first time I've met Josh, nor the first time we've had a chance to spend hours chatting, but the only other time we had a mic between us was a quick 30-minute thing at Joe Fest with Josh and Roger of After Action Report. This time we got to sit down over one of Josh's new projects, The Disavowed. It looks like a lot of fun. And after reading the first couple pages, I was excited to talk about it, not just about when he used to own the licensing for G.I. Joe Comics. This conversation is great, and we meander a bit, even though we were both kind of tired when we sat down. We were in the upstairs of the hotel lobby, so it is a little noisy with downstairs crowd volume and people from the sky bridges entering our space and walking through with no regard for two guys with mics. There is one part of this conversation I do want to mention. Josh brings up the Mandela effect. And I hadn't gotten to that part of his convention ashcan. And so it sounded cool to me, but I didn't have the context to really ask a lot of questions around it. So I'm sorry, Josh. But for you guys, just know that the comic will include these great commercials for cartoons and comics and toys that never actually existed, which gives us as adults a great buy-in to make up what we want and to build this world out in our heads and with our own action figures, as well as being a passive reader. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up. But I enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do too. Keep an eye out for the Disavowed comic when it comes to Kickstarter and your local comic shop. And if you see Josh at a show, get a commission drawing or just chat with him. Excellent conversation, and I hope you enjoyed as much as I did.
Dude, I just right off the gun, the file names are very fun.
Oh, thanks.
Assembly Required, preview night, Friday night, Des Moines, Iowa, 12th year, 13th year? I'm not sure. Assembly Required has been going for a while. Josh Blaylock and I are sitting down after dinner, so we are exhausted and tired and ready for a nap. And so half of this podcast might just be snoring, but this is your second time at the show.
We're unreasonably tired for such an early hour.
Yeah, to be only 9 or 10 o'clock. Ready to be done, yet we still have another 4 hour halves.
Illogically tired. We'll be up at like 2, like, woo! No, it's my second time, yeah.
And so the first time you went, it was because we were doing the Dreadnoughts. And you are a tripler, quadrupler of the Dreadnoughts.
I guess so. Well, I think I'm the first person that made them like the put in the concept that like they're like a national gang with chapters. This is like predates Sons of Anarchy, you know? So that adding some characters, adding Zanya.
Yeah, because they were supposed to be Australian, but they were always in Florida. And so you just expanded and
that got into like one of the last Joe things I ever wrote actually was like, yeah, Zartan's origin. And I might challenge myself was like, I'm gonna take the comic book stories, which there was some conflicting stuff in there. The cartoon, the toy bio, the changing colors, you know, from the, like, all that stuff. I'm trying to make it all work together, which part of which meant you had to explain, like, how does this Australian guy, these Australians, and then, like, this really weird eccentric Zartan dude and this British dude, because Buzzer is, you know, British. And then all these guys are in the Florida Everglades.
Constantly.
Yeah, so, and I think I made it work, but it was also the most interfered with story I've ever written for Hasbro either. So there's a lot of changes we had to make. So like took the most challenging story I'd ever done and got the most unnecessary pushback on silly stuff. Still pulled it off, like, hopefully, but yeah. People seem to still have fond memories of it.
We'd already seen Larry try to make him a ninja, or not try to, did make him a ninja. So we've already seen like the pretzeling of Zartan's stories. And then, so you were trying to pretzel it in a different manner and then had to jump through extra hoops, which is probably maddening.
Well, Larry, like, self-admittedly didn't care about keeping the continuity that straight.
Correct.
But I was like, no, I'm going to figure it out. the ultimate Marvel, like, Stanley no prize, like, entry, like, no, here's why it all happened this way. So,
when we talked at Joe Fest last year, which was like a quick 30 minutes because you were about to go have dinner with Larry. He keeps coming up. We had just barely touched on, like, you grew up with G.I. Joes. You were clearly obsessed by G.I. Joe to an unhealthy degree because you built a business. And
yeah, it was, I don't know, just, you know, like certain things stick in your head versus others. Like, I just always remembered the characters and continuity and all that stuff.
Because I don't know which part of the country you were in at the time. I know you're Chicago-based nowadays. But were you in the backyard with these things? Were you taking them apart? Were you blowing them up? Like, were you doing all the normal kid shit? Or
everything except the blowing them up part. Like, I was the kid that got mad if you just, like, banged them together. Like, why aren't you having them do a cool, like, fight moves? Like, you know, ninja kicks and stuff. Like, no, I grew up in I was born in Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
So I didn't have any siblings until I was about 7 or 8. So I had 3 sisters. They're all way younger than me. So my closest thing to like family brother to play with was my cousin Ray. He's like 6 months older than me, and that's who I played Joes with. And then it was always like a which toys do you got, you know, versus, you know, which ones do you have, and you just combine them all together. And then so yeah, we were always playing with them. And then I moved to Florida when I was like 9, and that was still G.I. Joe was still huge. So that's literally was like a way to meet the other kids. Like, what's your collection? And then you spend the night at each other's houses and have these big battles and stuff. But I don't remember what, pretty sure it was like almost immediately. Like, I'm taking screwdrivers. We're all taking them apart, making our Frankenstein Joes.
Yeah.
And then I would draw that character and be like, oh, this is my guy now. And I made up a whole story of this ongoing series. I literally did it for like 3 years, I think, which is a long time when you're a little kid.
I mean, that's decades for a child.
Yeah, I did. It was the USGI versus Fang.
That's amazing. Do you still have any of that
laying around? Oh, yeah, I've got all of them.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, they're pretty awesome. They're pretty terribly awesome. It's fun, though, because you can look back and you can see, like, well, at the very beginning, it's like, okay, this is definitely like a little kid. But you can see, you know, when a kid's passionate about something, how fast they improve. And I'm like looking at something like, you know what, actually, that's pretty decent, like, storytelling. Like if a 10-year-old brought me this and they're like, you've got a good concept of like sequential pacing for a comics, which I've seen 30-year-olds not have, like, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, when a kid is, that's like, you know, I wasn't like a protege, but, you know, if a kid's got a passion about something, they really,
once they start diving in, I mean, the more you do it, the better you're going to get. And for building a story for 3 years, I mean, that's a lot of skill building before the education of comics. So, I mean, that's not bad.
Yeah, it was weird. It was like, I was born like drawing, and you don't even have a memory of starting that. And also, I don't remember ever drawing for the sake of drawing. I wanted to draw and tell stories combined, and I wanted to be an animator when I was like 4 or 5. But it's weird, like, you know, it was really comics I was drawing the whole time, though. So I think it was like 12 when I realized, oh, I want to be a comic book artist, not an animator. I mean, it was definitely like, got G.I. Joe comics when I was like, you know, 8 or 9 and started making my own. Totally not rip off G.I. Joe comics. Yeah.
I mean, we've all ripped off G.I. Joe and Transformers, ripped off Thundercats a few times. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do.
Oh, yeah. I also had the Terracons versus the, oh, what are they called? I forget. But the good guy leader was called Trime. Lightning Bots. It was a Lightning Bots versus like the Terracons or something like that.
Excellent.
Yeah.
How else is a kid supposed to learn? That's amazing. Yeah,
it was just, we're all AI.
I mean, I was so voracious for comics, and that was the pinnacle of storytelling for me for most of, probably until like my late 20s, early 30s. Once the comic books, those long boxes started to take over portions of the home, I was like, okay, maybe I don't need this many at once. But to that point, like we talked about, I have all of your G.I. Joe stuff. Like, I have all of the Devil's Due stuff. Maybe not all of the trades, but certainly all of the floppies.
I don't even have all of them anymore.
But you built them, so, like, you don't have to have them. But
I got the files somewhere.
Right. I had to have them. It was a way for me to reconnect with something that I loved that wasn't around anymore. And then when I got rid of a lot of my comics, I kept everything that was G.I. Joe, Marvel, and DDP, and IDW. And then anything a friend worked on. I don't need to keep every comic, but if a friend worked on it, I should keep it.
I've always had that thing, which is like, this is like totally blasphemous to say as like comic book publisher, but I'm like an anti-collector. Like, I'm an anti-hoarder. I have to force myself to keep things. I just want to throw everything away.
That's beautiful.
And it's like, I'm like, I can just get it again later if I need it. And it's hard for me to hold on to stuff. And it's like, before we were recording, I was talking about like how many times I moved and like, I just moved from different state when I was like 9, and I was always lived between two parents' houses like half the week, and then all of a sudden it was different states and jumping, you know, flying on airplanes back and forth, and then in my adult life I'd move all the time, and so I think like it makes you just kind of zen about, you know, I'm almost more like stressed out if I own a bunch of stuff.
Then what you've done with your passions is appropriate, right? Instead of collecting it all, you started creating it all.
Yeah.
It gives a different context to the hobby. Whereas, like, I get stressed out by how much stuff I have because I move a lot, or I used to move a lot, but I also love collecting things. And so I find it quite beautiful to be an anti-collector in that way.
Well, it's almost like if it's in part of your job and you're at the conventions all the time, you're always surrounded by it. So if all of a sudden I was like ripped out of that and I was like, I couldn't go to a convention for 10 years or 5 years, and it'd just be like COVID, you know, I think like all of a sudden 1 year goes by and you're like, oh, I need to rekindle. I need to get a hold of all this stuff. You know, I need to reconnect. But then it's also chicken and the egg. It's like, is the reason why I don't care if I put some time and effort into actually like making nice displays and, you know, keeping some of this stuff, what I want to like have more of it.
Yeah.
But I would always just like purge. I would, like I got really, really into the designer toys. And well, I went in high school, I was all into the McFarlane toys and all that stuff because that was such a game changer. And then in the early 2000s, mid 2000s, I was into all the vinyl toys, like the like kind of hip hop designer cartoony toy stuff.
Yes.
But all along, all the time, I would get to where I had a lot and I'd just sell it all. And I would use that money to start buying new stuff. So it's kind of like purge it as an excuse to buy more.
I mean, it keeps you in the game. I think there's a lot of us that talk about this every time we get together at a show of, what else do I need? Oh, I haven't bought much at this show because I have everything. I've got to get into a new line, but I shouldn't get into a new line. So having an anti-collector or a purge mentality, I think, is really beautiful. And I wish I had a little bit more of that. Even though I love what I own.
Classified, G.I. Joe Classified was one of the first things in a long time that got me to buy some stuff. I was like, oh, those are pretty, damn, those are cool. I have a lot sitting in my Amazon in like cart that I never actually pulled the trigger on, but they've been sitting there for like 2 years.
As an artist and as a writer, instead of keeping all the individual floppies and all the toys, do you just have bookshelves of like all of your old writings and your old art books? Do you purge that as well?
Well, books are easier to keep on your shelf. Yeah, like, but I purge books too. Like, and now the joke is like, I'd look a lot smarter if I'd kept all the books I've ever had, you know, because I've purged those probably 3 times, you know. I've probably got, I don't know, 150 books or something on my shelf, you know, and I, you know, would probably have like 500 or something, you know, it's almost humbling, like when you can work on stuff for decades and you know, put out a prolific amount of work, when you put it all in a couple copies of each one and some comic boxes, it's like, oh, there's like 4 boxes of stuff, you know. I can kind of cheat that a little bit because it's the Devil's Due archives. There's like, I still don't even have everything, but because we did have some fire damage and floods over the years, like, but I think archives that I'm always have around are like 14 or 15 boxes of stuff. This is just me keeping like a minimal amount of everything I've published that I've had. I don't know the exact number. I've published around 1,000 issues of different things.
Wow. That is impressive.
I just recently did the numbers on my own stuff. Like, I know what G.I. Joe. Well, I mean, I knew it, as far as the issues, that's easy because I did the first 25, did the Dreadnought story, did this Transformers miniseries, you know, some on and off, some stuff like that. But I just found Hasbro audited us.
Oh.
One time. Yeah, I think when they were like, when they were really being really weird about stuff, they were like determined to think, like, we were like, it was when they were like, Dreamwave went bankrupt. Somebody, they had to like crack the whip on the whole department, and they're like trying to find some reason, somebody to blame on something else. Honestly, they audited us. We were totally fine. I just found those spreadsheets. So I was like, oh, cool. Here's all the numbers. So the books that I know, the books I wrote, we sold about 2 million copies of just the Joe books that I did, and then about $6 million worth of books.
That is wild. It is impressive.
I've never done that. You know, like, with, like, that's when you kind of want to flex and put your, you know, you'll see like an author. It's like they've sold over 100 million copies worldwide. They're adding up every book they've ever done, you know, and it's like, how many Joe books have we done? Which is, now I have those numbers.
That's very impressive. But I think that's kind of a neat thing, like over 1,000 books published and having those numbers of in the millions.
I think about over like 200 and something of that was G.I. Joe books.
Yeah. I'm a bit floored.
Well, it's like, I look at that, I'm like, oh, this is where my 20s went.
Sure. This is the thing, is we, like, so many of us who are fans of comic books grew up wanting to work in comic books. Less than 1% of us actually do, right? But none of us ever consider this side of comics when we're, it's all we want to draw, we want to color, we want to write. No one's like, we want to be audited. We want to have to deal with the archives. We want to deal with...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Every licensing contract you'll do with anyone says, like, oh, you know, we reserve the right if we want to, like, once a year or something, and we can audit you. And it's always this... This is every contract. It's like, if we're wrong by... If you were off by more than 5%, then you got to pay for our audit. If we're wrong, then we've got to pay for the audit. So... The nice thing was Hasbro had to pay for their own audit.
Sure. Oh, that's the dream of every kid getting into comics.
Oh, that's why I wanted, yeah, yeah. But also, it's kind of cathartic, too, because you're like, yeah, motherfuckers, like, here, yeah, this is the $1 million in royalties we paid you. I'll add it up here.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Post that, you still had a very lucrative, very, like, strong career in comics. You're still doing Devil's Due. And recently, you've started coming back to Joe shows and re-engaging with the community after being away for a little while. And now you have a new comic coming out, which I know you've talked about on other shows and YouTubes, and it's all over the place, but it's not in Diamond yet.
Yeah, it's funny. We're just talking about USGI versus the Fang. It's not that, but it's not too far. So I haven't touched... or been asked to touch like a G.I. Joe book in like 14 years.
Yeah.
Probably.
But you still have these paramilitary stories in your head.
Yeah. Well, I had this idea on like how to play with some of this stuff, or the way that, you know, when I'm not comparing myself by any means to Alan Moore, but when Alan Moore is like, how would I tell a superhero story? Or Garth Ennis is like, how would I do The Boys? Or, you know, even Kirkman's Invincible, that stuff. It's like, okay, how do I play with these archetypes of G.I. Joe and other 80s action stuff too. It's called The Disavowed. So it's about the United Five, a top secret task force put together by government funded quasi corporate organization in the 80s. And the United Five is made up of members of the different branches of the armed forces, formed to go up against a cult turned terrorist group with esoteric leanings and special abilities called Komodo. They had this whole saga in the 80s that went down, and it finally came to a head in like 1989. And to this day, there's still elements in the military that harken back to that. There's stuff happening now affected by it. So that's what The Disavowed refers to, former members of both teams that still work together. And for the reasons, it's unknown.
I like The Disavowed name. I think it's very clever.
I don't know what you're talking about.
it's very clever for many, many reasons. United Five isn't just like five people. It's an organization.
It's a playoff for the five branches.
Right, the five branches.
And I haven't forgotten Space Force.
But Space Force wasn't in 1989. You know, United Five Plus now, I guess. But the artist you're using, and I don't want to mispronounce this name, is it Pop?
Yeah, Popman.
Popman. His art is great.
Oh, he's fantastic.
It's dynamic and fast. It has a good feel of movement to it. And you have one page in particular, your roll call page has one guy in the middle and has all these pie slices all the way around. And it just screams a good, like, that's a great roll call page.
It's like very modern, but also feels like a classic call out. Like, yeah, he's awesome. It's funny. So many people that like know his name, like they know it from this book in the 90s called Spy Boy. 90s or early 2000s, Dark Horse put out. But you look back on that and it's like, it looks nothing like his stuff now.
isn't that the goal of any good artist, is to continue to grow and not look like we did?
He's done a ton of stuff. He worked for DC and Marvel only like recently a few years ago, and then he left for a couple of years. He was just not happy with projects he was getting, and he had other opportunities. And this, fortunately, was like something that, this is what brought him back to comics. He really liked it, thought it was something he really like sink his teeth into and challenge himself. And then he also immediately started getting other works too. So he just did a Army of Darkness series with Tony Fleeks. But he's been working on The Disavowed for the last year and a half, on and off. He's through the second issue now, about to start on issue three. And he's got an awesome, like, he really understands like good storytelling from panel to panel, but he knows when to stop and just crush it on like one page or one panel, and when to be simple with the other stuff.
So are you just doing the writing, or are you doing the layouts? Is he doing his own layouts? Or
I'm doing, he is not big of like a Joe nerd as I was, or some of the 80s stuff like that I'm trying to like really reference. So I'm doing the designs that are like,
okay,
I'm like, this is the specific thing that's going to hit right. And I give him the designs, and then, he goes from there. So sometimes he'll tweak it, but it's a little back and forth where I'm like, oh no, this part was really important. We got to keep this element. Other than that, yeah, he's full on just doing all the art. I'm not doing layouts or anything like that.
That's still a really good collaboration between the two of you. And I like when not Joe people come into G.I. Joe or into those realms that are inspired or feel like, in this, like, he's not, you know, an 80s pop guy. Like, that's great, because it brings a new freshness instead of it just being the same old thing over and over again, right? Like, we've been in this for so long that it's gonna feel like you've been in it for so long.
I'm also like, I really want to play into the two, like the whole nostalgia of like, there were other things going on in this era that affected everything else. Like, we all think about, like, okay, G.I. Joe, you know, was a military with this weird blend of ninja and all that stuff, you know? And, like, but also completely separate from that was the direct-to-VHS video movie phenomenon, where, guess what? Half the low-budget movies, they were either, like, shitty commando military movies or ninja movies, like, shitty ninja movies.
It was a great time to be into,
you know,
into,
we're all, like, 10 years old, 9 years old watching these rated-R action movies. You know, and it all blended together. And then you throw in, like, you know, some weird, like, movie like Cyborg or some, like, sci-fi thing. But I'm like, this was as much of a vibe.
Yeah.
And it was also, it's funny because of the era, if your parents are like me and my dad, like, and my uncle, like, didn't care. Me and my cousin are watching these movies. I don't know if they were even really paying attention. Like, at the same time where we're watching, like, these cartoons that have to be kid-friendly, we're watching this super, super violent, gory, like, live action stuff. And every other kid at school was too, you know? And then you're going out to Target or Kmart or whatever, getting an arsenal of realistic looking guns to go play with. And so that was part of the vibe too. I'm like, that's as much of like the nostalgia I'm thinking of when I am like, you know, doing these, like, I want to have fun with that. But like the setup, the premise,
I think that's a great way to honor that whole period, because you're right, there's so much going on there. We all watched Nightmare on Elm Street in the fourth grade.
Yeah.
Deeply inappropriate for a 10-year-old.
Or you would spend the night at one kid's house with five other kids, and the one kid had the movie, and you're like, we're going to watch this when my mom goes to sleep.
Yes. Our whole world was so deeply inappropriate, except for cartoons. Yeah. So I love that, and I love that you're baking that in. And like, I've read the first seven pages, and before you jump to the next thing is like, with you and Pop, you're also bringing in Carlos's colors. Is it Badia?
Yeah.
His colors look very modern, but also look... he has a nice way of coloring that.
Yeah, we talked about that a lot before he started. Yeah, he's this amazing colorist out of Chile. Yeah, he really wanted to like hit both. Because comic coloring right now has actually kind of come full circle from this. Like, it's actually now replicating more like pre-computer coloring, like 80s style, early 90s style, before the image explosion changed coloring forever. It's almost like less rendered. And there's some comics now that are like extremely super simple. And he's striking a great balance between like, I think both. We've even talked about like when it's in the 80s, should we separate that more? Another stuff that's a little more nuanced that people might not even pick up on is the lettering. When you're in the 80s and the Disavowed, the lettering is different than when you're in the present day. The lettering looks more like present day lettering, which tends to have more lowercase, uppercase, or just different types of fonts.
Yeah.
And in the 80s is a lot more blocky. Yeah, it's not super in your face, but if you're looking for it, you know.
And who is managing all of that?
That's Sean DiPasquale, who's actually also story editing on my book. So he's way overqualified, like just to be lettering. He's a great letterer, and he likes to do it. So he's like story editing that for me. He story edits for a lot of other people. He's actually Charles Soule's story editor, who's like a New York Times bestseller.
Yeah.
So it's a really good person to have on my team, like looking at the story and, you know, giving it fresh eyes.
I mean, that's incredible. Lettering is always the invisible art form anyway. It's only, you only know if it's bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I do drive letterers crazy because I'm trying to get better about it, but it doesn't, no matter what happens, when the art's drawn and the dialogue comes out on the page, something's off every time. And with this one, because it's in the middle, anytime it's a brand new series, the brand new world, you'll have like one little sort of unresolved thing. Three issues in, you'll think about it and it'll change everything back. And it's like, if that first issue hasn't gone to press yet, you're like, oh man, I'm sorry. Can you change these two words? It's going to make a big difference later. I put him through hell on the first issue. And now he actually was trying to start on the second issue. I was like, you're not allowed to start yet. I have to go through and change the script first. The setup, I think, is okay to say to people, like, for the Disavowed is, you know, it starts in the late 90s, actually, with a couple of the kids who are, like, 11-year-olds, almost, like, nostalgic, like, you remember like, yourself as a kid playing, you know, at this around the same age. They're getting in the one kid's aunt's closet, and a kind of American, very American story, like, they find his late father left something that she's been hiding, and it's a gun. So it's like, oh shit, two kids found a gun, and they got in the backyard, and it's turns out it's a 92 Beretta, and they're gonna mess with it, and all out comes a laser. So it's like, what? And then that sets, and then all of a sudden we're in 1989, big battle. You realize this is like a very significant battle, that there's a lot that came before this, and it sets the stage for the whole thing.
Since it's the first two pages, I guess it's not that big a deal to talk a little bit about it, right? It gives nothing away. When I read that, my first thought was like, you know, they have the lockbox, and he's like, you know, I spent weeks trying to find the key, and I'm like, Jesus, Josh, are you going to give us a gun? And of course you do. And then I'm like, how dark is this going to go right off the gun? And then it's a laser, and I was like, oh, good. So I barked a little bit, like, oh, okay, good.
Like, perfect. That was a laser. That's like, good. Like,
I'm like, come on, Blaylock. Like, how dark are we going on page one? And also, the other character in that first page is talking about a pager. I laughed because that was the time period. Not the 80s, but when you're talking about the mid to late 90s.
It was the older cousin. She's talking about this guy never paged her. She paged me in color back.
We all had pagers. We had pager codes. We did the whole thing. So that was nice and nostalgic and something to look up for a younger reader, I guess. But then, you know, when you flip over into that first battle, the dialogue is appropriately like 80s action movie cheesy, and the code names are delightful.
Hell yeah, thank you. I feel like I was channeling some other like nerd source to the code names were flowing like that. Those really like.
I didn't know if you wanted to talk about the code names at all, like specifically, but there are a few that I really liked, and so.
I mean, I don't know where to start on. There's Dane the Great as the team lead, and then there's Chef and the Wall and Gadzooks, Peaches, Blue Sky and Stormy. He's got it's like the jetpack guy and his pet sugar glider. There's got to be one animal that has no business being on the team going into combat.
A sugar glider is quite a fragile creature. And you're like, you know what we should do with this?
No more
this,
fragile than a parrot.
This fragile creature right into combat.
That sugar glider can dodge lasers way better than a parrot.
Sure, the parrot at least can bite and claw.
Yeah.
and then there's Dial-Up, and which is a great name.
What's funny is the amount of obsessing that goes over like Dial-Up. I'm doing all this absurd stuff, and then I get to dial. I'm like, well, could you call the name Dial-Up in 1989? Like, okay, well, how did the internet work back then? If you're in the military, you had access to the like, I go down this whole rabbit hole, and like later on, there's mention of like, I wanted to have, you know, someone saw like basically like email communications, but I'm like, man, how do you describe email in like 1989? And I want it to be, I'm like not worried about like the squirrel that the flanks, the sugar glider attacking people, but I'm like this email's got to be right, but. No, and then you're like, okay, it was called an autogen file, and they actually did have this. It was part of like the electronic cables that would go through. Like, so you find yourself like for 2 hours researching that to get like two lines right.
You're gonna end up having like a whole history on how Telnet works,
and I got to way too much about sugar gliders.
Your FBI file is gonna be weird.
That's the best defense, man. The more and more they get intel on us, and like the more the ChatGPT remembers everything we ask it to, like it'll be like yeah, but I'm a writer, man. Yeah. I have to look up all kinds of weird shit.
I found it very fun because the code names are they have a good feel.
What's your
to
favorite
them.
Code name? Huh? Or what are your favorite code names?
Well, I really liked Blue Streak and I liked Dial-Up a lot. Blue Sky.
Sky's the limit.
It has that nice, like, older feel to it. You wouldn't see a Blue Sky in today's naming. And, you know, he shows up with a jetpack and he's got the blue uniform.
Yellowstone was another one, too. I was happy. Like, I couldn't believe Yellowstone wasn't taken. I was like, whoa. And he's a native, but he's also, like, the kind of like a hillbilly wild. He's a pilot guy. Yeah, that stuff was all fun. And honestly, the modern code names were fun too.
And I haven't gotten to the modern because it's a 7-page ashcan, but I'm enjoying where it's at so far. I'm liking I really do like how it starts in the 90s, goes back to 89, and that it's specifically in 89. The Comics Authority code is gone. There's some good like
yeah. This is not G.I. Joe for this is not for children. Or you know, maybe if you're a teen to read when you're not giving it to them, but you're okay with them reading it.
Well, that's when you were like, you read this before Alexander reads it. I was like, he's 13, he'll be fine. But then I read it and I'm like, oh, well, there's some violence.
Yeah, and I'm not going to be held by just violence either on it. So it is, I mean, they're marketing it as G.I. Joe meets the boys. So like that's the ceiling they're putting on it. It's not being misrepresented, you know. However crazy it gets, it's not quite that crazy yet, but but yeah, no, it's funny. You remind me, there was a guy one time because I just that book Mercy Sparks I do, which is definitely not for kids, but it's about this devil chick that works for heaven hunting rogue angels, and this guy asked me one time, he's like, do you think my 16-year-old daughter would like this? And I was like, well, I probably, but I can't say. He goes, let me rephrase that. He goes, would it be okay if I gave her this? Or do you think it'd be okay for her, but I shouldn't give it to her? And he was like, he's like basically saying like, you know, I know she's an adult enough, but is it not cool for your own dad to give you this book? I was like, that was a fun self-aware thing. But it's, I mean, the audience that's into most all this stuff is like older anyway. I did want it to feel like if you are someone that grew up with it and you see all these like flashbacks, you're gonna get all these Easter eggs and references. But I really wanted it to also have that if you get this kind of new G.I. Joe stuff or whatever, like, and you're like, okay, yeah, my older brother was into that or my dad was into that, and you're like 20 years old or whatever, and you're reading it, you're like, no matter how big of a fan you were, like, nobody knows these new characters' names anyway. You just appreciate it. Like, you get, like, exactly what you said. Like, it's, they feel like they're from that era, and that's all that matters. Like, it's a vibe. For the person who's younger, newer to it, they're just, it's more like about when you hear your older relative telling a crazy story that's like kind of inappropriate and like a little Wild West, and you're like, what the hell were you doing? That's what I wanted to feel like when these flashbacks happen. Like, you know, these guys are like, they have guns that shoot lasers, and they're all like, they're not wearing any traditional uniforms, and they're like all muscled up and mustaches. Like, they're getting coked up and running into battle and fighting these crazy supervillains. You're like, what the hell was going on in the 80s?
Yeah, I mean, is it the wall that has the Hulk Hogan stash?
Yeah, he's the one there. Say, looks like Gung Hogan.
Yeah. And then the codename Gadzooks made me laugh. Because what a... Who chose that as their name? Like, yeah. I want to be known as Gadzooks.
I don't know.
And, you know, I'm a Roblox guy. So when I see Chef and there's like two...
Do you think they're similar?
They're two knives.
I don't know what you're talking about.
On his belt, I was like...
He might be a bit of a psychopath. He's known to use those kitchen knives in battle. And his catchphrase is, now we're cooking.
That is the fun and the joy of what you get to create is like, yeah, we can go, oh, here's a parallel between what you're doing now and this G.I. Joe thing we know. But you also get to go, oh, is there a parallel? Now let me turn it as far, like, let me crank that dial and see how far I can push it. In one picture, I can say, oh, this reminds me of that, but I haven't gotten that far in, so I don't get to. I haven't seen how you've cranked that knob on this character yet, and that's the fun part, right?
Yeah, because you're any story where you're every. I mean, every major. Yeah, you know, it's hard to name any character that didn't start out as like taking a reference from another character,
absolutely,
and then just being like the whole. That's the whole joke. And it's like, and then, but you do have to within like the first story or two put a twist on it. That's like, okay, now. By the time it's like two more layers removed from that, it's completely its own thing. That
its own thing. Yeah,
it can't be that like clearly the boys are supposed to be Justice League, but like by the time you get, you know, a few issues, then you're like, okay, this could never in no way turn itself back around to be Justice League again. It's
right.
It's its own thing. We get it now, but that premise and that setup and using these archetypes lets you throw people into a world without having to overexplain everything.
And that's where like I don't want to rest on I'm going to like this because I like G.I. Joe, or this is just G.I. Joe 2.0 or anything like that. This is its own thing that just happens to be lovingly homaging or playing with or even poking fun at G.I. Joe. We have a lot of that shit in the world, and that's good. And so I am excited by it. There's going to be 5 issues to start.
Yep. Yeah, that's just...
May go further if you decide you're not done at the end of 5 issues.
Oh, yeah. There's so much because, like... I mean, that's just a safe way to start a series. You have to tell the stories. There's going to be some way to have closure, have a collected edition and all that. But, I mean, there's already years worth of stories, you know, if it's successful enough. And so we're also treating this as if it was actually, like, a brand back then. So outside of just reading the story, I'm acting like it's like a Mandela effect where like, oh, you don't remember the Disavowed? I was like, you know, you didn't collect the United 5 growing up. What are you talking about? And
perfect.
That means there was an 80s version. There was a resurgence in the 2000s. There's fan communities that have their own opinions about the relaunches. There's letter columns from back in the day. There's all that stuff. And there was ads. And so that means, and there was like, there were PSAs.
That's a lot of extra work you've put on yourself to really build the vibe.
It's great because we don't have that. I mean, we don't have to do it. But like now, if I've got an idea for a character in the background, I don't necessarily have to have them be part of the main story. Doesn't mean stop someone from being like, oh yeah, I if people want to get in on it, they can. Like they can talk about how they used to love that character and they hope he shows up more. You know, have fun with that.
I giggled a lot. There's a panel where Dial-Up logs into their system and he remarks on their like 3 megabytes.
Oh, yeah. Like they got 300 megs or something like that. Like these are me.
If this man pulls out a 3.5 floppy.
Oh, yeah. How many like holographic computer programs from 80s cartoons ran on a floppy?
Yes.
A real floppy, not even the small plastic floppy. like 5-inch thing.
Odd story. In 87, in April of 87, I ended up moving to Illinois, the middle of corn, Illinois. And I was there for 7 months, and then we moved again. But I was in the principal's office being introduced to the teacher who's going to walk me to class as these adults are like freaking out. And they were like, have you ever seen anything as cool as this? And they pulled out a 3.5 floppy.
Oh, wow.
And they were like, we've never, like, how did they turn a floppy this small? And it's really rigid. And I don't have a ton. I don't have a great childhood memory. Like, I just forget a lot. But it's one memory that's always stuck with me. Because then I go to class and we're learning, like, computer programming that day on a 5.5. And, you know,
yeah.
Everything had the, you know, you slid it in, you clicked it, you clicked the lockdown. And so when I'm reading things like Disavowed and they're talking about pagers in the 90s, I'm very much having that visceral like moment. And yeah. Then we go back into 89 and dial-up is talking about like is being very specific about this would have been an enormous thing. I'm like, oh my goodness. Like,
which is even more absurd because really what Komodo is doing is something almost equivalent to like magic with like this technology stuff they have going on, which is comes up later. But it's funny too, because I have a similar story where I remember like it was probably around the same time. It's probably like 86, maybe. I don't know. Whenever the Mac Classic came out, my stepdad was one of those guys that went out and bought it. And
nice.
I don't know. Took out a loan for like buy a $3,000 Mac Classic. And I was allowed to use it, you know, to use Mac Paint and
wow.
But before I was allowed to get on there, I had to play some typing game for like 15 minutes. So I learned how to type when I was like 8. And
just
I,
so
by
that
the time
you could
I got
draw.
To yeah, then when I had typing class in school, I didn't accidentally turn this off, did I?
Nope, doesn't look okay. Like it.
Yeah, so my parents did their job. They like made me like accidentally learn how to type by what blew my mind more is he was working at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and he was also taking some like classes something to do with that. Like he would dial in, push the buttons on the phone, connect it to the computer to use the internet to dial in on some like military system. And I didn't know there was no one else doing that. Like it was just this is before the web. And I was like, whoa, what is happening?
So the first time you watched War Games, you were like, that's what Dad does.
Yeah. But it was also, you're a kid. So it was just like a boring thing. It sort of, I was like, what is this? But it's like, well, I got to call into work. It's a thing. Then later on, you think about like, well, that was incredible.
I've actually sat Alexander down in front of War Games. He thought it was an amazing movie. But just watching the technology, he was like, is that how computers worked back then? I was like, I mean, I wasn't rich enough to know. But, you know, a few years later, it was simpler but similar. But yeah, having your dad being doing that very thing, I think is a lot of fun. And you can pull a lot of that in now.
Yeah, yeah. But then a big part of the series jumps to the present day, too. And we follow the...
So, like, present day being, like, the 2020s?
Yeah, yeah. So the kid we meet in the 90s sort of, like, is... He organically became the character that carries us through this world. So I didn't even plan that originally. That's one thing that the story kind of did it on its own.
So he's going to be about our age-ish.
Yeah, yeah. A little younger. I want to talk about it because I think it'll get people excited about it, but I don't want to reveal too much. But in the present day, I really want to get into like modern top secret fun stuff now that's based on what people are really talking about. Like yeah. The government's admitting is real, crazy technologies they admit is real now, but they can't say anymore. And you can guess what that is. But it all has to do with actually like, it's not what you think it is. It has to do with this old 80s battle that happened and it's being affected now. So
I think that would be very fun, and so I absolutely want you to tell me everything, yeah. But I know like that's probably not the smartest idea because you want us to buy it. When is it going to be in Diamond? When are we going to be able to tell our local comic book shops?
I hope sometime, there's no, it's got to be out by like Q1 of next year.
Okay.
So, I mean, but there will be opportunity to launch like the Kickstarter and all that stuff before that. I'm waiting on, So this is the first time in 20 years Devil's Due has worked with another publisher. It's going through Massive Publishing, and they're setting the release date on it.
And that was going to be that question was, is this going to be a Devil's Due product? Is this going to be something else? And now you're mentioning Kickstarter, which I don't know if you've done Kickstarters for other Devil's Due products.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, I've been all about Kickstarter for a decade. And we've very frequently done books where we do a... Now every publisher's doing it. But, I mean, I started that in, like, 2012. Like, we'd launch a Kickstarter with special items, but then at the same time solicit it through the catalogs for the stores, and we're sending everything to press at the same time. And now, so Massive is doing it as a part of a new series of books they're doing. Like, it's the pilot launch. So it's these first issue pilots, but we're definitely doing the series. It's not like we hope the pilot works. Yeah, because we're already, I mean, I'm writing issue 4. Pop's pretty much done with issue 2, starting on issue 3. You saw a bunch of colors from issue 2 yesterday.
By the way, I like the colors, but I think Tim Finn is the one that very openly said, you could release this in black and white and I'd buy it all day long. I love the colors, but he was not wrong when he said that.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we can do a black and white version of it. Like, that's one fun thing about Kickstarter and capabilities now, where you can send stuff to press digitally at very low runs. And we'll just do like an artist edition or something like that. Some of the stuff's so crazy detailed.
Speaking of the crazy detail, so Pop, we've already mentioned how much I like his art, and evidently everyone is too, because he's been gone for a while. He gets 2 issues in with you, and now other people are trying to pick him up as well. But one of the things that last night, we were standing at The Grove, I think. It's a tap room and bar. We're just kind of chatting. You throw open your phone, and you showed one of the panels, and it's a van, bus, armored transport. Yeah,
no, we haven't had a name for it yet, but it's awesome.
Right. And from behind me, Alexander 13 pops over and goes, I want that as an action figure vehicle. And to me, that's the best compliment that this type of book can get. Now, I mean, that's to me.
Because I haven't gotten to show it to any, like, many kids, especially because it's a more adult book, too. So for someone who's that age to see it just from the distance, be like, what's that?
Can I buy and play that?
Yeah. You know, I honestly, that's what people, like, especially companies lose sight of, is some of the fun elements of, like, the characters in the stories aren't just the people. Character, you know, like in G.I. Joe, there's vehicles are just as much characters.
Very much.
You know, in G.I. Joe, there's basically, there are vehicles that are just like the problematic now, but like the General Lee, you know, or like Kit, you know, like yeah. Just there, you want the, like the Batmobile, you know, that's a character.
Very much a character.
And it's funny too, that's the part, I'm sure part of it's because like, I'm putting all the thought into these character designs. So he's just kind of like drawing that. And then when he's drawing the vehicles, he's just riffing on that. So the energy comes through on the vehicles, and he's accidentally creating things that we're going back now, being like, okay, that one was awesome. Let's make that. Let's say that's a real thing.
And it's very much a beautiful vehicle. It's blocky and simplified, but also has like a lot of detail into it. And if somebody put that in plastic, I'd have more than one in the house. Like, yeah.
Once he said that, I was like, you know, this is one of the more 3D printer friendly looking vehicles, just because of its blocky shape. Yeah. And it can hold a lot of shit.
You know, that's one of the things that I'm looking forward to the most with Disavowed is, at this point, so many of us that are deep into G.I. Joe or have been into G.I. Joe for most of our lives or came back to G.I. Joe during COVID because we were bored and had eBay, it's easy, like you said, like as you purge, because I can always go back and get this, it's easy to recollect O-ring G.I. Joe. Or the 4-inch G.I. Joe from 06 to 18. Now you can just buy classified all day long. So if I want to go back and collect the O-ring G.I. Joes, which, I mean, I don't have to go and collect. I already have. But if I were to start today, in a couple years, I'd be pretty good. And we have so many people and groups that have taken that love of the O-ring or the 4-inch or the 6-inch Joes and have started independent toy companies that start very much like you were talking about with Chef or anybody else as a quick homage, and then they turn the crank and see how much they can twist what started as a loving homage into a completely unique and separate thing from G.I. Joe, where our passions began. And I'm friends with these independent toy people. I'm buying their products. I'm excited to have their action figures in hand. And this, to me, feels like that same thing. And I might be wrong, but that's how it feels to me as I'm flipping through the first couple pages, as I'm seeing.
That's what I was, because, I mean, getting reconnected into this whole Beyond Comic specific toy convention scene, like, and just seeing all the amazing stuff coming out is like seeing the potential. I see the potential there, like, oh, this is, there's an audience for this stuff, you know, but it's very, very, very hard to make toys. And it takes so much money and it takes so long to get the toys made.
We can also say that about comics.
Yeah, but like, I do, like, it's almost like an unfair advantage that I'm happily taking advantage of. Like, anybody can make the comics if they got the right resources and talent. But like, I do, I'm trying to take advantage of having the name, having the history to make my thing. And then knowing that the toy potential is there.
Yeah.
Whereas everyone else who's in this specific world kind of has to make the toys and then they're trying to get their comics made just because they want a story behind the toys. And it's like, and there's some really, really cool stuff out there. People are doing amazing stuff, but like, you can't do it that way. If you make the comic just to be about the toy, your toys take so long to get out. It's like hard to tell any stories.
You could also fall into a trap of, I have this really neat toy and this comic book has to build a real world. Whereas you're like, I have a comic book that is building a toy. And I think there's a difference of like, if you have a toy and you're making a comic book, make them cohesively like toyish. Well,
and that's the difference too, where like these toy brands, they're very clearly being like, no, we're homaging these toys and we're making, like, this is what we are. Like, I'm just being like, look, this is its own story. Like, it's clearly homaging this old stuff and its own art, but it's on its own path. So, and I hope we can do some really cool toy stuff. And I think where we have already got some conversations going about that. So,
oh, that's very good to hear. And this is the right show for that.
Well, and that's what I want to do, though. I do want to bring it around to like, I'm at a show like here, like Assembly Required, and going to Joe Fest, because this is where the real indie like talent is, and it's where the true genuine fans are that are like it. So if we can put that all together, we could have a really successful indie toy line, like, you know, about 2 years from now. So I hope and then we'll have all the comics already to like do fun stuff with, repackage or do like, or do special editions of and all that. And then you know, and it, I, because of the way we're setting it up, like, we can have like McFarlane style, classified style, 6-inch toys. We can have like 80s versions, you know.
If that never happens, we have a great story. And if all of that happens, then we have great things for our shelves. And I think that's like, just from the 7 pages, just from the art, just from this conversation and knowing that this is, yes, it's an homage to Joe's and that passion, but then adding in, but not just resting on that, but then bringing in like that VHS culture, that staying up all night with Nintendo culture, that the pagers, the,
yeah, I want to sell an like a 3¾-inch figure that comes with a firecracker.
Like, well, I mean, cops and crooks did the snap guns, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh man, yeah. The whole like VHS thing is a whole thing that, not even a month ago, I went to Music Box Theater in Chicago. It's like an old timey movie theater. And they're known for doing like, well, playing old movies and having like big events out of it, making events out of it. They did Ninja 3: The Domination.
Oh, wow.
And I swear to God, man, there was like 200 people there on a weekday. And it was, you know, everyone's having a great time. And I'd say like half, 2/3 of the audience was, you know, under 30. So that was awesome. You know, everyone's just going to see this cheesy old ninja movie who have no idea, like, you know, for anyone that's actually seen that movie, we'll get this. And if you haven't, you'll be like, what the hell am I talking about? One of my friends was involved in organizing that event, and they go up on this stage beforehand and they just start saying, who wants a V8? And they throw out cans of V8 to people. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, just go on YouTube and look up Ninja 3: The Domination V8 tomato juice.
Or just watch the movie, stream the movie. Holy shit. I had something keyed up and then you tell this story and I start laughing and then my mind just goes blank. Since I can't remember what I wanted to say.
Guess that means we're done.
Yeah. Throw the mic on the floor and stomp off. Earlier today, I handed you my sketchbook. And I've talked about this many, many times. But my sketchbook started because Drew Moss, who is currently drawing Thundercats, is a friend who convinced me to start a sketchbook so that I could commission him to draw on it. And I've gotten a lot of friends to work in it. I've gotten Ron Rudat to draw on it. And every time I've seen you, that sketchbook is at somebody else's house.
Oh,
yeah. Because that sketchbook has traveled all over the country. I very rarely have that sketchbook at home, which I know is not normally what people do with sketchbooks. And I also know that...
Yeah, that sounds nerve-wracking.
Yeah, a lot of people have a lot of anxiety about, like, the cost of the art, and then you're just putting that in the mail. But I... Yes. So this time, my friend John Earl, he had the book, and he's had it for a few months. He did two big pieces in it, Mutton Junkyard in the front, and in the back of the book, he did Tanker and Clank, which is from the Operation Recall toy line that's coming out.
Yeah.
And I handed you the book today. You did an awesome hooded Cobra Commander. We talked for a minute. And you were like, can I do hooded? And I was like, yeah, that means there's seven other Cobra Commanders for somebody else to choose. And the whole point of that book was that it's a nice collaboration of what would you like to do? What's your favorite character? And, you know, obviously somebody like Ron Rudat or Larry Hama or even Mark Pennington, they're going to, I don't fucking know. What do you want? And I'm like, all right, do this. But for the most part, like, it's been a conversation, and every piece in that book has been something that the artist wanted to do, not something I asked them to do. So when you said, I want to do hooded, fuck, good. We didn't even
talk
about it. I think
I kind of was like a joke at first, because you're like, as long as they're not already in it. And I said, well, I guess that eliminates Snake Eyes and Cobra Commander and Storm Shadow. And you're like, there's no Cobra Commanders in there. And I was like, I'm thinking like, really? So then like, but he hooded, well, one, the helmet Cobra Commander is a bitch to draw. It's just getting that angle right.
And then there's even more angles if you do the battle commander.
And the hood is just like, he's got a little McFarlane cape on his head.
Yeah.
So it's just fun to draw. And I'm a sucker for just seams. I like any character you can add seams to, like the sleeves and the gloves and extra padding and stuff. It's fun to add on to the character for details, especially when it comes to like convention type of sketches.
I really enjoyed it. And I needed to get the book over to Larry Hama.
Who's he drawing for you?
He's not one I'm going to ask to, what would you like to do?
Oh.
So anyway. I asked him to do Destro, since this weekend's theme is Iron Grenadiers. And Destro is someone he's written a lot that he knows the character. It's not like I'm going to ask him to do Iceberg, you know, who got like, what, three panels out of 155 or 300 issues. So I needed to get it over to him. The last time I asked him to draw on this, he said no. And he had a reason that I thought was really depressing in terms of, like, his fans. So this time, this is a different show. It's a lot smaller of a line. We talked before the show was open, so he might be seeing me a little bit different than just the average attendee, because I'm there during setup.
Yeah.
And he said yes. So when you were done with it, I rushed it over to him. But if there is time tomorrow, based on your own commission list, I am hoping to, or it may have to be the next time I see you, I'm hoping to get a disavowed character in the back of the book.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I need practice drawing them anyway. One thing is, like, when you design the characters, but you're not the artist on the book, you draw them a couple times, and then you're like, you might go 5 years and never draw them again. And it's like, I'm doing shows with these characters from the beginning. I have to draw them more. So I've already gotten pretty good at drawing the Mantis from memory and Peaches.
And I'm hoping for a disavowed character for the same reason that I have Operation Recall characters and Call Sign Longbow characters and Skeletron characters all in the back of the book.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
Because these are our modern independent, maybe they started as homage, maybe they're a flat-ass homage, but they are also their own unique thing. And I like having that. The front, I mean, it's the mullet of sketchbooks at this point. The front is all business. It's all G.I. Joe. And the back is all the party. It's all the, it's all the new, you know, passion-driven things. And so I would absolutely like to have a disavowed character in the back of that.
Awesome.
I still don't remember what I was going to ask before I started laughing. And I know that it is getting close to 11. You have to drive tomorrow, but we're both exhausted. I don't want to take up too much of your time.
No, I mean, it's awesome to sit down and be able to like catch up at the show. And I guess so we made a real simple way, because I got tired of like links changing all the time and not knowing where to send people. I made there's a domain now, disavowedcomic.com.
Oh, perfect.
So disavowedcomic.com right now, it goes to the Kickstarter landing page, the pre-launch page, which even if you're not going to do the crowdfunding thing, it's going to be where you can see new stuff and we'll be posting information there. And you can also, and you know, once that's done, just go to disavowedcomic.com and we'll link it somewhere else or it'll be its own site. Yeah, and on socials, I'm Blaylock Comics on Instagram and Josh Blaylock on Twitter.
Devils Do Productions is still Devils Do Productions.
Yeah, Devils Do Comics on Facebook, Devils Do on Twitter, and go to devilsdostudios.com.
As you mentioned this call to action, all of your links, it did remind me of what I wanted to ask.
Now he remembers.
I know. I have backed like 200 and some odd Kickstarters. I love the Kickstarter model. And I have things that when I look at Kickstarter campaigns, the extras, there's certain things that I look for and I love. There's some things that I'm like, I don't really give a shit, but if it's there, it's there. You've been doing it since 2012. So you, like myself, from the very beginning of Kickstarter, deep into it, obviously from the opposite side, I've been buying, you've been putting. What are some of the extras that you're thinking about in terms of the Kickstarter and this?
I'm working with Massive on it. They're going to actually run the Kickstarter this time. Okay. So we're deciding, but they want to do, I don't know what they're wanting to hold back as like a surprise, but they want to make sure every single cover on there is something you're definitely not going to be able to get in the stores.
Okay.
And they also usually have some unique triggers for stretch goals that will like trigger like something the retailers can get.
Okay.
And so I don't know what that is yet, but I know sure. They also like with the Zorro campaign they did with Sean Gritter Murphy, they had a thing where like, if it raised a certain amount on the stretch goals, it also opened up a variant that the retailers could get so that the retailers were excited to see the campaign do well.
That's awesome.
We're trying to keep it a little simple because it's really easy to get out of hand. It's always a fine line. Do people really want that or not? You know, but I mean, we're definitely talking about like dog tags and like cards, like ID cards, collector cards.
Nice.
There's, upgrades on different covers, like are we gonna do metal or you know things like that. They did an amazing metal cover that they're not gonna do for the Kickstarter, just to keep it special because it was only at the Comic Cons and it was the one at San Diego. It was a metal cover of the United 5 logo with blood splatter on it. It was like a raised blood splatter.
Oh wow!
It's the coolest metal cover I've ever seen.
I've sold metal prints, but I've never seen a metal cover on the book.
Oh yeah, I've done a lot of those recently.
That's pretty
like,
cool.
Yeah, they're fun.
For me, I like stickers, bookmarks, and t-shirts, but that's just my personal. Then there's so many different things that you see and people do, and posters and prints and original
t-shirts
art,
are the like hard one of the harder things to do because like they're not that popular
and they raise your shipping cost.
They raise it. You can't do media mail and they're like your margins aren't as good.
Oh, but, they're garbage margins.
But
yes.
Then you're like, yeah, but then people have a t-shirt and they're wearing it everywhere. Like and it. It's easy to get to when you do a Kickstarter and you're like, you know, you're used to thinking in the stores, you have to sell thousands and thousands of copies to have a successful thing. And you might sell like, you know, 800 books on a Kickstarter, but the money is up there because it's all retail price and it's as good as selling thousands to the store. And then you're like thinking, oh, well, we only did 160 shirts
or right.
and you know and you're like oh that's com-, you know you're thinking like that's not and then you see them all until you got to go pick up 160 shirts from your store and that's what becomes
that's
like fun about it. You're like, man, look at like this many people are all gonna be wearing it. Like
yeah I
that's why I like Kickstarter in a way that a lot of creators dread. I get excited when I'm like looking at an amount that when you really actually see it in person you're like, oh man, there's like 300 things here I have to sign, you know. That's awesome. Like each one of these is going to someone you're like, oh, it's like, why do we do this? You know, we want to know people are reading it and having fun.
I'm excited for it. And so you said the website is Disavowed Comic?
Disavowedcomic.com. Yep.
Perfect. And then, I mean, at this point, I think everybody knows how to find you, but you also gave all of your social media stuff. And if we're looking for this Kickstarter and this comic in Q1, dude, that's going to be exciting. I can't wait to go back and reread those 7 pages and kind of when I'm not on a show floor and I have time to dig in and get really nerdy into each panel.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Alexander's going to pick it up and read it if I even without me asking him to, because he knows who you are. He's had these conversations. He looked over your shoulder and saw the pictures of...
The first issue is all just good old heartwarming gratuitous violence. So, you know.
Well, I mean, he's been a G.I. Joe and a Transformer and a mask and a Starcom fan for his whole life. he's already good with gratuitous violence.
Let's end it here. Thanks again for spending time with us discussing toys and other geeky things. Our logo was made by Rhino. The music we use was created by Self Help. You can find Joel on Instagram at Order of Battle Pod. Jason is on Twitter at Order of Battle PD. Our email is orderofbattlepod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, and thank you for your likes, comments, outreaches, and just being here with us.
This has been the Order of Battle.